Greetings, friends. My name is Jessa McLean, and I'm here to provide you with some blueprints of disruption. This weekly podcast is dedicated to amplifying the work of activists, examining power structures, and sharing the success stories from the grassroots. Through these discussions, we hope to provide folks with the tools and the inspiration they need to start to dismantle capitalism, decolonize our spaces, and bring about the political revolution that we know we need. In early May of this year, 9 people launched a lawsuit against the University of Calgary, the Calgary Police Services, and a host of individual police officers. The suit focuses on the violent police action that targeted Palestinian solidarity activists who had set up an encampment on the university's campus back in May of 2024. In order to tell the stories behind the lawsuit, we put together this podcast mini-series. We called it Setting Precedent, the Right to Protest on Campus, because we also want to understand the suit's larger implications on the movements that we talk about here on the show. In the first 2 parts, we heard straight from Rahele and Wassam, both plaintiffs in the lawsuit. They gave detailed accounts as to what happened to them that night, why they were there, and how they were attacked by cops. We asked them what this lawsuit means to them and what they hope to get out of it. You can listen to the episodes really in any order, but I do suggest you listen to them all. We're at the 3rd part of the series, and we're about to hear from the activist's legal counsel, Chris Wiebe. He's going to go over the arguments and the merits of the case, and just how these institutions and individuals named as defendants violated his client's charter rights. Because of how the law works and the fact that these kinds of overreaches and charter violations are happening more frequently, the impact here could be big. Lots of lessons as well on how the systems work or don't and how we can maneuver through them or why we should even. Next up in part 4 will be a discussion with Dr. Rebecca Lexier, an expert on social movements who has her own podcast mini-series on student power in Canada. She'll help explain why the university reacted the way that they did and what this means for the larger movement for Free Palestine. If you enjoy this type of content, chances are your friends probably do as well. So do everyone a favor, share it on your socials. We need the boost. All right, that's out of the way. Let's get to part 3.
My name is Chris Wiebe, spelled C-H-R-I-S, W-I, E as in echo, B as in bravo, E as in echo, pronouns he, him. I'm coming to you from Amaskwatchewaskaigan, otherwise known as Edmonton, in Alberta, Canada. I'm a lawyer at Engel Law Office. I represent the plaintiffs in the U of C Palestine protest encampment lawsuit.
We spoiled the surprise. No. Yes. Yeah, so we've called Chris here today because of a lawsuit that was announced. And we, of course, had to follow up on this. If you'll look in the show notes, maybe in 2024, we spoke to Jeremy Appel about this case. It goes back to the encampments, the student encampments for Palestine. They all had different names, but that's what we're talking about. And a lot of them were forcefully removed from their own campuses. But I think none of them really compared to what happened at the University of Calgary, not just in terms of the violence inflicted on students, but also the level of, I will call it, there's a lawyer in the room, so I feel like he's watching me for this, alleged collusion between just the communication levels between the province, the school, the cops, and the fastness in which this happened, right? They were not tolerated for even a moment. So that was seemingly said and done 2 years ago. Why are we talking about it now? Students and or activists, because there's professors and community members involved in the plaintiffs, are fighting back through the courts. Chris is helping them do that. Chris, can you give us a lay of the land and what that statement of claim looks like in terms of the complaint in general?
The complaint primarily is about breaches of my client's rights under Section 2 of the Charter to freedom of speech, freedom of peaceable assembly. They were gathered in an encampment on UFC campus to protest Israel's ongoing genocide in Gaza and to pressure the university to disclose its investments in companies that are complicit in that genocide and divest from those. It's also about excessive force. The very same day that the encampment was set up and the university immediately issued trespass notices, they pretty quickly called the police to come, and they did come. And that evening, violently, with use of chemical munitions, shields, batons, forcefully removed my clients and other protesters, which included students, alumni, faculty, parents of students. Most of the force, I understand, my clients are alleging was used after they had already began to pack up. The police chose to advance again in a more forceful fashion and causing significant injuries to my clients. There's a 60-plus-year-old woman who was there to support her son, who is a student, who suffered, it's not clear if it's like a bruised or a fractured rib, but that was painful for a couple months for her. There's a handful of concussions, a jaw injury, but mostly talk a lot about the trauma of being on the wrong end of a police, what would you call that, a siege like that, and having such traumatic experiences as being, you know, on the ground, being beaten by a police officer or multiple police officers, or having chemical munitions explode by your feet, which happened to a couple of my clients.
When you say chemical munitions, do we mean tear gas or?
The police say that it was OC grenades, which is like pepper spray grenades. Both a loud sound and then irritates the eyes. All this in response to what was a righteous act of peaceful assembly to protest ongoing war crimes and a Canadian institution who hasn't disclosed their investments in companies complicit in those war crimes and genocide. The lawsuit is partially about compensating my clients and vindicating their rights to freedom of speech. It's also, I think, an important legal action for setting precedent. If we let the charter continue to be reinterpreted by police, by our institutions in ways that disallows peaceful protest and we don't push back, then that's really dangerous for democracy. It's dangerous for civil rights in this country. The countries where police respond to peaceful protests like that are not the sort of countries that Canada should be seeking to become like. This legal action is, I hope, will be a way to correct course in reminding our governments, our police forces, and all of us that the right to peacefully protest, it's a constitutional right. It can't be abrogated by purported exercises of authority under the Trespass to Premises Act by a public university, which is what their defense is. The Trespass to Premises Act is the provincial law in Alberta that under which private landowners can tell trespassers to leave or else they get a ticket, which is what the university did with the help of the police in our case.
I was talking to you earlier about some of the language used in your statement of claim, which I'll attach to the episode for folks to take a look at. You mentioned that, you know, by the way, this institution has still not disclosed its investments in companies complicit in genocide. Is that one of the ways that you are trying to keep the focus on Palestine? Because anytime we've had activists in here, and you know, you did disclose this beforehand,
there's this hesitancy to be at the front of the movement, you know, to be a plaintiff with a name and a face and perhaps even a monetary, you know, award, and be talking about them when, you know, there's Palestinian prisoners being executed and what's going on in Gaza. And that's really what they were doing there in the first place. So
yeah.
Is that the reason for you including that language there? Do you think that'll be relevant to the judge?
I think that the allegation about the university still not disclosing and divesting from companies complicit in genocide is important, both for keeping the focus on the core issue here, which is the suffering of the Palestinians. And also it's relevant allegation that hasn't been proven in court yet about the reason for their malicious overreach against my clients. Like, what, why did they act so quickly, and why did they act so violently to displace peaceful protesters? It goes to the money and also trying to set a precedent that undermines people's right to have a say in where our institutions invest.
You also take time in the statement of claim to point out the different treatments of different plaintiffs.
So four of my clients were issued $600 trespass tickets. And two of them, two young white men, not too different from myself, were given the type of ticket that has like a voluntary $600 payment option. And then two of them, both West Asian women, were given summons tickets, which means that there's a mandatory court appearance. And if you don't show up for court, then there's risk of further punishment, including up to 6 months imprisonment. Peace officers in Alberta are only supposed to issue those kinds of tickets if it's in the public interest, with regard for basically whether they're a flight risk or whether there's like a long history of these people committing similar offenses. And my client's allegations is that none of those factors existed. So why were they given these summons tickets that came with greater criminal legal jeopardy?
It's very obvious why and how, to me, you're alleging that police infringed on charter rights, right? Especially with the violence, like that, even people who don't understand the law, that seems inherently wrong. They can kind of make those conclusions. Why include the university in the lawsuit itself? How did they allegedly infringe on the rights of protesters as an institution?
Because they're the party that immediately upon realizing that what the students were doing, issued notices under the Trespass to Premises Act. In other words, get out. They're the ones who did not consider my clients' rights under the charter to freedom of speech and freedom of peaceful protest. Did not consider that the encampment was not posing an obstruction or any safety risk. Just immediately decided that the encampment was to be prohibited from U of C campus, and asked the police to come do what they did.
One thing that I'm always very curious about is the tools to hold police accountable in Canada. I know here in Ontario, we have the SIU, which is the police oversight, which is staffed mostly by former cops, which means that they rarely, if ever, find them guilty of anything. I'm curious what the systems to hold police accountable for their actions are in Alberta, as well as whether it's simply fines or if there's any higher consequences for whenever they overstep their duties.
I'm sure there's similarities and differences. We just had amendments to our Police Act, which is the legislation under which police accountability functions in Alberta, just in late 2025, which I'm still learning and getting the hang of. But in broad strokes, if there's evidence of a fatality or serious injury, a vague term that has led to some confusion, then the equivalent of the SIU, which is ACERT, we call it ACERT, it's the Alberta Serious Investigations Response Team, takes over, and they're mostly, from my understanding, former prosecutors investigating those serious allegations. In this case, the government of Alberta had ACERT do an initial limited scope investigation into whether any serious injuries occurred. And this is my client's account is that they provided evidence that several of them had gotten concussions, and ACERT decided that that didn't constitute a serious injury. And so ACERT declined to investigate further because it wasn't within their mandate, which I think, you know, and you can talk to Jeremy Appel more about this, but I know he published some texts between the Premier's Chief of Staff and the Chief of the Calgary Police Service about that limited scope investigation and making sure that the scope of ACERT's involvement would be limited to that issue. From there, because ACERT's not involved, the CPS just gets to investigate itself, and did so and disposed of all my clients' complaints. Those dismissals are currently being appealed to the Law Enforcement Review Board.
I mean, it doesn't surprise me that it turned out this way. And yes, our discussion with Jeremy, if folks go back and listen to it, he does detail just how they were able to maneuver afterwards, and coordinated statements and whatnot to downplay what had happened or to boost up the necessity of clearing the encampments. It was, it was shocking to hear even then. So I'm interested in why students are choosing this as a path of recourse. Is it a level of vindication as well? Because the monetary compensation that they're asking for, considering what they've been through, seems small. I'm not your judgment, I'm sure, is fine there. This isn't a comment on what you've chosen to do, but it just seems like the focus is less on that and more on getting someone to admit that their charter rights were infringed on. Is that really what they're looking for?
Yes, the primary goal here is for a court decision saying that this was a violation of their rights to freedom of speech, peaceful protest assembly, similar to what the U of A students are doing with their legal action. My clients are also seeking damages, as you mentioned, for personal injuries, out-of-pocket expenses incurred from the $600 tickets, and alleged defamation by the CPS chief. We've also claimed damages because I think it's important that where there's such an egregious breach of the charter as there was in this case, that courts award damages to deter that sort of egregious state misconduct. That's not just me saying that. That was a big theme in a Supreme Court of Canada decision from 2010 called Vancouver and Ward, where it talked about damages being awarded to the charter for three purposes: compensation of personal injuries and losses, vindicating not just the plaintiff's charter rights, but everyone's charter rights, upholding the charter right itself, and deterring that sort of state misconduct. So that's why damages are important to include here, although they're not my client's primary focus.
Can I ask, because my legal understanding is admittedly limited, but so is this civil or criminal? Is it simply monetary, or will there be, can people lose their jobs over this on the police side? Or, what are the consequences, I guess, for violating people's charter rights, you know?
Yeah, purely civil. We would just be getting going for a court order declaring the charter rights were breached and awarding damages to my clients. City of Calgary and the University of Calgary would be vicariously liable for those damages, and the CPS chief. There's no criminal liability or risk for the defendants. Whether there's any employment consequences is up to their employers.
The university and the police force. So what else would a victory look like? Not just for the plaintiffs. So a court order declaring that charter rights were breached, would it help other students who've been treated similarly in other provinces? Or is that precedent, say, just for Alberta?
Precedents set in one province aren't binding on another province, but they are persuasive. And courts in one province will certainly give a serious look to decisions elsewhere in the country. The way our court system works is that decisions of the Supreme Court of Canada are binding on lower courts everywhere else. And then decisions of our provincial courts of appeal are binding in the province of that court of appeal. But other than that, decisions are persuasive. So it does have a precedential value. If a court were to uphold my client's Section 2 charter rights here, that would mean something, I think, in Ontario. And if God forbid, people found themselves in similar predicaments to my clients in the future, and there's this case from Alberta that says that that's wrong, then that does help, I think. And I think police forces look to the development of the common law in Canada too, and see how courts are interpreting people's Section 2 charter rights. So there's precedential value elsewhere.
I'd love to ask, because obviously we've seen like this resurgence of encampments in defense of Palestine, but obviously for the unhoused community, encampments are a constant issue where they're also facing a lot of police violence with those clearings. Would a victory here offer any additional protections, do you think, for unhoused encampments in Alberta?
Not unhoused encampments. This would be specific to protest encampments. So encampments where there's a specific freedom of speech and peaceful protest component. Now, there have been encampments that have been both. In Edmonton, during the pandemic, early pandemic, there was a camp called Pekawewin that was both an encampment run by and with and for unhoused community members, but it was also about prayer and Indigenous stewardship of that land, which had significant sacred value to a lot of the First Nations that have called this area home since time immemorial. So there's some examples of encampments that have been both, but usually homeless encampments, unhoused encampments, the section of the charter that protects those is Section 7, the section that guarantees everyone life, liberty, and security of the person.
I had a question about building the case and filing the statement of claim. In the defendant's list is the name of quite a few officers. Then you've also included some John Doe officers, I guess. I'm guessing, now correct me if I'm wrong, obviously. You were able to gather the names of some of these officers from recordings of the day, from witness statements. How did you get that information? Because what I'm getting at also is, what could other activists do to aid in a situation like this? Was there information that they gathered or continued to gather that helped make this even possible down the road?
The names of the officers listed in our statement of claim were learned through the Police Act complaints. Making complaints to police forces is, as a lot of people know, like it leads to a lot of frustrating results, you know, officers investigating their own. But it is helpful for getting information, and that's the primary purpose for listing individual officers too, is there's it makes it easier for pretrial questioning to get more evidence that might be relevant to my client's claims. If there's a lesson to activists, I think it's just that, like, there's a few reasons why engaging in, albeit flawed, police accountability processes are still worthwhile. And one of them is because through the complaint process, you learn more about what happened and who was involved. That's what led to us learning some of the officers' names here.
That's actually probably quite helpful, although each province might have a different structure, different procedures for people to follow. Just because, you know, we are exhausted of going through all of these loopholes, and even hearing that your clients are pursuing a civil matter while also appealing the dismissals of their complaints, while probably navigating being a student and a mom and like all the other things that come with life, while also being a part of a movement with a greater goal. This is also overwhelming, but if you're saying it pays off, you know, let's encourage folks to sometimes go through this. But not everybody will have access to legal counsel. Do you find yourself stretched thin? Are there lots of cases that people are asking you to take like this? Or, you know, because when we speak to tenants, for example, they say there's hardly any lawyers out there that can help them. Like, it's very few that specialize in what they need. Is that the same for folks that are trying to pursue claims like this?
Oh, man. Yeah. There's like, I mean, I could count on one hand the number of lawyers that take lawsuits against police and prisons in Alberta. There's huge demand for more lawyers to do this kind of work. There's obviously practical challenges to suing the government on behalf of individuals of various means. And I think that's a big reason why there are so few lawyers who do it. And we need more.
As a bit of a follow-up to that, you know, again, with my limited knowledge, but, you know, when I observe what happens in the States, it seems like lawsuits against police in the States are a very common practice that happens all of the time. Why is it that it seems to be so much more rare here in Canada? I don't know if you can answer that, but
so I'm not an expert, so take this with a grain of salt, but my understanding is that there's more reason to sue in the States because American courts tend to give much higher damages awards, so there's a lot more incentive for suing, and there's a lot more lawyers willing to take the bond contingency, because even if most of the lawsuits don't earn a return, still, even if you get like a couple that do, the damages award is so huge that you can still pay your bills that way. Maybe I'm reading too many Grishams, but that's my general understanding. And I think Canadian courts are understandably in a lot of ways reluctant to have a civil justice system like that. But I think one of the downsides, while you don't get as many kind of bad faith litigants, it also makes it a lot harder to make the numbers work as a law firm trying to pay the bills and do this work.
So there's no, you know, thriving law firms that just represent clients wronged by police and educational institutions. It's not a niche market yet.
I mean, my boss has been doing this for decades, longer than anybody else in the province, and he drives like a piece of crap, like 98 GMC pickup. So,
well, you're not helping to appeal to more lawyers. We were speaking to law students here for a second. I think we might have lost them. Come back. it is rewarding in so many other ways, right, Chris?
Yeah.
Although, you know, we don't often have lawyers on the show. It seems like when we do, they're also activists. Like, I don't know if y'all can admit that or not, what your restrictions are, but just from the language you've included in your statements and the way you carefully speak here, and I don't mean the alleged and haven't been proven, I mean just the acknowledgments that you give and whatnot.
I don't think I am an activist, or like I'm not experienced or trained in organizing or anything. I think as a lawyer, we have ethical duties like within our profession to make sure that everybody has access to the courts and to uphold the Constitution. And I think that's enough. That in itself is enough reason. I think for me personally too, like I grew up and am like a Christian, and I think that there's enough like religious and moral beliefs in my life that motivates me to work for the oppressed and the poor and against war and war crimes and genocide and people profiting from that. So that's what I am. I'm a lawyer. I'm a human, I'm a Christian, and that's all the reason I need to get involved.
Well, you see, not all lawyers are bad, right? You guys, sometimes I think you get a bad rap. No, we've had some good folks on here too. Then we are very pleased when we find movement lawyers. Reluctant activists, fine. We'll reserve that label for now, but your work is very much appreciated in the movements. I'm sure you know that. I hope you feel that.
Thank you. I just want to say thank you for your kind words, and also that, you know, I think lawyers have lawyers like us who are involved in these kinds of social justice causes. You know, we have a lot of mutual respect for organizers and activists who do make it their business to engage the consciences of the masses, and that's something, that's a skill that as a profession we generally don't have, and we tend to arouse more suspicion and disdain from the masses than sympathies, so I don't think I am an activist, partially because I think it's a very distinct and important job to do community organizing and activism. That was all just a message of mutual respect and appreciation. And thank you both, Jessa and Santiago, for having me on the show. It was wonderful to chat with you both.
That is a wrap on another episode of Blueprints of Disruption. Thank you for joining us. Also, a very big thank you to the producer of our show, Santiago Halu Quintero. Blueprints of Disruption is an independent production operated cooperatively. You can follow us on Twitter at BP of Disruption. If you'd like to help us continue disrupting the status quo, please share our content. And if you have the means, consider becoming a patron. Not only does our support come from the progressive community, so does our content. So reach out to us and let us know what or who we should be amplifying. So until next time, keep disrupting.